Call for Action presents Of Consuming Interest, a public service show that discusses scams, deceptive offers, and other consumer concerns. Here's the director of WUSA 9 Call for Action and your host, Shirley Rooker.
When faced with a legal issue, many consumers feel daunted by the cost and complexity of our legal system. Well, making the legal system accessible is the goal of my guest today. Consumers for a Responsive Legal System are working hard to help us understand and access the legal system without it costing us an arm and a leg. And my guest is Tom Gordon. He's the Executive Director, Consumers for a Responsive Legal System. And you can find their website at responsivelaw.org. And they've got a wealth of information on there for useful information for consumers. So before we talk in great detail about some of the issues that we're going to talk about, just tell our listeners some of the things that you have available on your website that they can use, tools that they can use.
Sure. We have several things to help people learn where to find information in the legal system. A lot of people don't know where to go to find a lawyer. They don't know how to approach that process. They don't know what to ask a lawyer when they're hiring them. So one of the key tools we have on our website is a client's bill of rights, which is 10 rights that you either have under law or should ask your lawyer for when you're going and shopping for a lawyer.
And making a contract with a lawyer should be right at the top of your list, shouldn't
Absolutely.
It?
You should get it in writing. If you go to a lawyer about some other matter, if you have a dispute with your plumber, for example, the lawyer's going to say, well, did you get a contract in writing? And the answer better be yes. And the same goes for a contract with a lawyer. That should absolutely be in writing as well.
Is it common? Do lawyers commonly come out with contracts with their clients, or do they feel like they are above that?
I think some lawyers just don't feel like it's necessary. Some lawyers are very good about doing that. It obviously varies, much like it would with any other profession.
Sure.
But any good lawyer, if you ask them for a written contract, any good lawyer would agree to that.
Okay. And I hope they're not going to charge you for it.
Oh, no, that shouldn't be an extra charge. Absolutely not.
We always have to think about the charge. Always. Well, and I know that you all have been fighting to get paralegals more access, getting consumers more access to paralegals and so on. But there have been some major issues that have come up in the last year or so that you all have been addressing. And I think one of them has to do with the whole issue of self-regulation of lawyers and how this can be an antitrust issue. And are you all part of a brief that's been filed in court about this issue?
Right.
You want to tell our listeners, because you can do a better job than I can.
Absolutely. There's a case that was heard in October by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's called North Carolina State Board of Dental Examiners versus Federal Trade Commission. And you might think, well, this is about dentists. What does this have to do with my access to the legal system? Well, the case is about whether a state board of dentists, which is appointed by dentists, is allowed to make decisions about who can do things like teeth whitening. You may be aware that there are people besides dentists that do teeth whitening. And in this case in North Carolina, the state board of dentists said, no, these non-dentists are not allowed to do teeth whitening services, despite the fact that these folks were cheaper than dentists and did just as good of a job. So the question before the court was whether this is an antitrust violation for the dentists to be self-governing in this way and prevent competition. Well, if you substitute lawyers for dentists and paralegals for tooth whitening, you have a very similar situation to what's going on in the law. So we filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief in this case, pointing out to the justices how important their decision would be, not just for dentistry, but for access to the legal system, which is, I think, much more important than having a pearly white smile.
Yeah. Well, it can certainly cost you a lot more in the long run.
Sure.
That's absolutely. So if in fact this comes out on a positive from your viewpoint, what would it mean for consumers?
What it would mean is there would be some limits on how self-regulating the legal profession can be. You would need to have some sort of oversight, which you don't have today. Right now, the state bar in each state, or in most states, is self-governing. In other words, the state bar makes decisions about who can practice law, who can't practice law, what is the practice of law, and who can provide any sort of legal services to people. They also decide what is considered to be ethical and unethical and legal and illegal in providing services to consumers.
So this would go back to the case where I know there have been court suits filed against paralegals by some lawyers saying that they were practicing law without a license. Then that would be related to this, right?
Right. So if the legal profession were not as self-regulating, you'd have to have some input from the public at some level on regulations regarding the practice of law and the business of law.
And so you think this would open it up so that we could get paralegals who are trained, who often work with lawyers, but that we would be, have more access to paralegals to help us draw up simple things like wills and no-fault divorces and that sort of thing?
Right. It's at least a first step. This is really something that's necessary to get to that point.
Because to even get there.
Right,
okay.
Because lawyers right now, the majority of lawyers right now, or at least the majority of lawyers that are vocal and are governing the business of the profession, are the ones who say, no, we can't have allow this competition in. So if you had a Supreme Court decision that said you have to not be as self-regulating, you need to let other people be involved in the regulatory process, then those other people would be able to help open up the system and perhaps get other people allowed to provide services for people who need legal help.
Now, was this a Supreme Court case or is this a local jurisdiction?
No, this is a Supreme Court case.
It's a Supreme Court case.
So we're expecting a decision sometime before the end of the term in late June.
Okay. So hopefully it will come down on the side of giving more access to the law, because that's basically what you're talking about.
Right. Ultimately, a good decision here will open up the road to better access to legal help. A bad decision would leave us in the same situation we are now, where the legal profession, lawyers, are in charge of who gets to provide services and who doesn't.
Okay, now let's talk about some of those services that it might open up, such as for paralegals. Now, right now, how restrained are they or constrained are they? And does that vary by state by state?
It does vary by state, but in almost every state, paralegals are only allowed to provide services in conjunction with a lawyer. They can't provide services directly to consumers.
I see.
So you could have a paralegal who spent 20, 30 years drafting wills or drafting divorce papers for uncontested divorces, and that person's not allowed to provide services directly to you. However, I'm a lawyer. I'm admitted to the bar in District of Columbia and in Maryland, and I'm legally allowed to do that for you, although you would be very ill-advised to get that service from me.
Because you don't know.
I don't know. I've never practiced family law. But I'm legally allowed to
You could do it where a paralegal couldn't, who had a ton of experience.
Right. And so there's a few states where that law is not, or that's not the case, where there are some services that are allowed to be performed by licensed paralegals. So in California, there's what's called a legal document assistant. In Arizona, it's the same profession called a legal document professional. Mm-hmm. And so in states like those, there's a regulatory system in place to allow people trained as paralegals to provide help with document preparation.
And the real challenge here is to have oversight so that you make certain that these people actually have the training that they claim they do so that they can actually provide good services. Now, with a lawyer, you know that they have to be a member of the bar in order to practice law. It doesn't guarantee they're good, but it says that they have certain standards that they've met. So the same thing would be true. In order to call yourself paralegal, you'd have to pass some kind of a test.
Right, exactly. There's a test required.
Is there currently?
Currently, California does not have that, but I'll get to another situation that's another level of licensing in a moment. California does require that you be licensed by the state and that you be bonded, which, by the way, a bonding requirement is not required of lawyers. There's no requirement that lawyers have malpractice insurance.
Let's just take a brief pause here before we continue with this to let our listeners know they're tuned in to Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. You're listening to Of Consuming Interest. My guest is Tom Gordon. He's the Executive Director of Consumers for a Responsive Legal System. Their website is responsivelaw.org. They're a nonprofit. They're out there fighting the battle to help open up our legal system to consumers, giving us more access without having to pay such huge attorney fees for simple things like writing a will, if it's an uncomplicated will. So now you were saying that when we were discussing, I interrupted your discussion before. I do apologize, but I had to take a station break, you know.
So in what's going on right now in Washington State, is there's a new level of service that paralegals are going to be allowed to provide. It's called Limited License Legal Technician, which is a mouthful, so it's abbreviated LLLT, LLLT. We can just call them legal technicians for this purpose. And what legal technicians are going to be allowed to do is slightly more than just document preparation. They'll be able to help walk you through the court process, help explain forms to you, help point you to the appropriate resources you need, and do basically a lot of consumer handholding that consumers greatly need in guiding them through the system, basically helping people navigate the legal system. They won't be allowed to provide legal advice, but they'll be able to do a lot of other things.
Mm-hmm.
And that took years, over a decade, to get pushed through the Washington regulatory system and is finally going to have its first set of practitioners licensed later this year.
Now, Connecticut has done something rather innovative, too, in something called a super paralegal.
Connecticut's actually, they don't have that right now. We'd love to see them adopt it, but the Connecticut Bar Association has recommended it. A similar thing. They call it a super paralegal. You have different names for this type of work all over the place, but it basically involves a paralegal trained individual providing services on a limited scope. And so the Connecticut Bar Association had a task force about the practice of law and its regulation, and they recommended that the state adopt a system of super paralegals that would be allowed to help with things like divorce, landlord-tenant, or small claims matters.
I think that's extraordinary. Did you all have a lot of input into that?
It came out of the blue, really. This was not something we expected to come out of
there.
And now that we know that this is out there, we'll, of course, be pushing to see it come to fruition.
Okay. So, but that is similar to what is happening in some other states, giving it different names.
Right.
But so there is recognition that consumers should have some access to the legal system without having to hire a lawyer.
Right. And I think lawyers are slowly starting to come around as a profession to realize that people just can't afford their services.
Right.
They can't afford a $200 or $300 an hour rate for something that could be accomplished just as well by someone who's charging a lot less and who has training in that same area.
Are some states more repressive, if that's the right word, than others in terms of what paralegals can do now?
Absolutely. There's some states where you hear really bad horror stories. Florida, I think, is one of the places which has the worst horror stories of people being prosecuted for unauthorized practice of law, for doing things like helping out a fellow parishioner at their church with some with a workers' comp issue, for example.
Oh, my goodness. Just helping someone fill out forms.
Just helping someone fill out forms and explaining the legal process to them.
Oh, boy.
The Florida bar is very protectionist in that way. So some states are far more protectionist. We're seeing other states where there's always pockets of protectionism, but other states like Washington and California have been doing a generally better job and are more accepting of the need to have greater access to the system.
How do you rate our area here, Virginia, Maryland, and D.C.?
It's fairly middle of the road. There's been nothing horrible in one direction or the other, but nothing great either. We'd love to see some of these reforms enacted in this area.
Sure.
We actually just participated recently in a symposium that a section of the DC bar helped sponsor. The DC bar is not saying anything one way or the other on these ideas, but they were open to this forum.
At least
to
they
have
put
this
it
discussed.
Forth.
Right. And so there was an interesting symposium where some folks from local jurisdictions talked about legal technicians, and the Washington State folks also came to talk about their experience. And so we'd like to see that as a starting point for replicating that in this area.
And of course, the small claims courts here, we really need to get higher limits.
Right. Absolutely. Having higher limits for small claims courts can go a long way to helping people with
giving
their legal
access
problems. Right. People are priced out of getting help for their legal problems in many cases. If you have, say, a $15,000 home repair,
And that's nothing in today's home repair world.
Right. If that's botched by your contractor, you really have no recourse because you have to either hire a lawyer to go sue them for $15,000.
And you're not going to do that.
Right. Or you have a limit of $5,000 or $10,000 to go sue them in small claims court. And that's the only way you can do it without a lawyer. So you either have to lop off a large chunk of your claim or hire a lawyer, which is just not cost effective to recover $15,000.
No, it isn't. What are the limits here?
DC is, I believe, 5,000, as is Maryland and Virginia. I believe all three are 5,000. They may have had an increase recently that I'm not aware of.
That is
all right,
not
5,000.
Much money at all. Come on, state legislators. It has to come through the state, right? That would be a state.
Right. That's a state legislative issue where the state legislature
get off the duff and raise the limits. Right. I mean, I don't understand why. Is it the pushback from the Bar Association that keeps them from raising their limits, or is it just something that consumers haven't complained about enough?
It's a little of each. We try to get out there and complain about it on behalf of consumers, but there's a lot of pushback from the bar. Lawyers believe, mistakenly I would add, that they're going to lose business if the small claims dollar limits are higher. The fact is, lawyers aren't taking cases worth $5,000 or $10,000.
And you know, running call for action, we hear from consumers all the time. I mean, fortunately, we're oftentimes able to help them pursue a claim that falls in that middle ground where you're not going to hire a lawyer. It's not worth it.
Right.
And yet, we've also dealt with some much more value cases, but doesn't matter how little or how small it is to us, but to the consumer, it doesn't matter either. But how they pursue it is going to make a difference.
Absolutely.
So it's really strange.
And let me add that Call for Action, and maybe because of their reputation, has avoided any pushback from the bar for unauthorized practice of law. But technically speaking, any Call for Action volunteer who's not a lawyer is not allowed to give certain information to people lest they cross that line that the bar considers to be the practice of law.
Yeah, well, that would be an interesting battle. Since we've been around for 51 years now, can you believe that? Okay, the California legislature, you're talking about this, you mentioned this, that they've passed a law that would increase the ability of paralegals to do
It's actually the California Bar, and they've had a task force. The California Bar's leadership actually on their own came out of a retreat and said, you know, we've been talking about the access to justice problem in this country, and we think that one of the steps we absolutely need to take is to license paralegals to provide services directly to consumers.
Right. And that would be wonderful. Okay, let's just take a brief pause here. Time's flying by, Tom, to let our listeners know they're tuned into Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. My guest is Tom Gordon. He's the Executive Director of Consumers for a Responsive Legal Legal System. And you can find their website, responsivelaw.org, and they've got all kinds of things there, as well as a consumer's legal bill of rights. I know you have a lot of information that's used. You have information on wills and all kinds of places people can go for resources, hiring a lawyer, mm-hmm. all of that. And, you know, it is confusing to people who don't do this very often to figure out that they're going to have to do something legal if they're facing a divorce or child custody issues. It's kind of daunting, truthfully. All right, now what about the Commission on the Future of Legal Services?
Oh, this is an American Bar Association commission that just started meeting a couple months ago and is just getting started in the process of looking at how the legal profession of the future is going to deal with providing enough access to law for everybody.
This sounds very, very interesting and very forward-looking on the part of the bar to be considering what's coming down the pike. Do you think it will result in loosening of requirements and more access for consumers?
Well, we have a lot of hope that the commission will recommend smart recommendations to help consumers. That there's a lot of folks on this commission that have studied these issues a lot and recognize the need for innovation in providing legal services.
Mm-hmm.
We've submitted testimony to the commission already, and there will be several more opportunities for us to do so as they consider individual issues. But where these commissions generally run into problems is that a commission will be made up of smart folks at the ABA, and then it gets sent, any proposal they have gets sent to the ABA House of Delegates, which is really the most old school of the members of the bar,
mm-hmm.
and that's where things usually get held
Stop.
Up.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to make a very convincing case to get the American Bar Association House of Delegates to approve anything that a commission might recommend.
Well, how does our country stack up compared to the rest of the world?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we have a wonderful legal system. I love our country, but we aren't necessarily head of the pack when it comes to some things, right?
No, we have, in most respects, we have one of the best legal systems in the world. But when it comes to these issues of access to affordable legal help, we are really near the bottom. There's a study that the World Justice Project puts out every year called the Rule of Law Index, and they measure countries' legal systems around several dimensions. One of them is whether they have affordable and accessible civil justice. And the U.S. Ranked in their most recent survey 65th out of 99 countries that they looked
Uh-oh.
At. That puts us in the company of countries like Mongolia and Kyrgyzstan and several other countries.
It's
that
not
are
exactly
not
flattering.
The ones we think of as the top access to justice countries. It gets worse, in fact, if you look at how we stack up compared to our economic peers. They looked at 30 of those countries that were considered high-income countries, including the U.S., and the U.S. came in 29th out of 30 among those countries, with only United Arab Emirates.
Well, what are some of the other things that countries do that could be a model for us?
Well, there's a few things. One is, as we mentioned, allowing non-lawyers to provide some types of legal help, which is allowable right now in the U.K., for example.
Well, they have two levels of lawyers in the UK
right.
as well.
They have two levels of lawyers. They have barristers and solicitors. But beyond that, they now allow non-lawyers to provide legal help in certain contexts. The other thing, though, that can make a huge difference where the U.S. is falling further and further behind is allowing outside investment in legal practices. Right now, if you're running a law firm, you can't take outside investment. You can't take corporate capital. You can't take take investment capital and no venture capital. You have to fund it by yourself or with a bank loan, which means you're not going to get the economies of scale that could really help somebody. If you look at, you know, most major businesses, you look at, say, FedEx. FedEx is not running just on some money that the FedEx founders put up. FedEx gets money from all sorts of investors and therefore provides very efficient package delivery around the country. Lawyers can't do the same thing. Or you look at H&R Block, another example, providing tax service at an affordable rate to people around the country under a national brand. But there's no real nationally branded law offices because lawyers aren't allowed to take in outside investment.
Ah, so that hinders their growth in a way.
Right.
And hinders what they can offer.
Right. And so you look at other countries. In Australia, for example, there's a firm, Slater & Gordon, that is one of the largest law firms, if not the largest, in Australia and has offices actually worldwide. They have 1,000-plus attorneys in their main office, and they have it set up where you call in, you get triaged by an attorney who's answering the phone to find out, okay, here's your problem. We need to send you to this person within our company. They send you to the appropriate lawyer. You can deal with your problems on the phone. They'll be able to do it efficiently. They have lawyers who are able to be trained in specific areas of law by experts within the company rather than having to go get outside training. So that's more cost effective. And it leads to a very user-friendly experience and a much more cost-effective one where people can, you know, find a lawyer easily. It's nationally branded and they can get their problem solved in any number of consumer areas. This is not a large law firm like we have in the States where large law firms are serving primarily corporations. Mm-hmm. This is a large law firm that serves the people.
Wow. And there is no model similar to that here.
It's not allowed. Every state forbids
because of the regulations per state.
Right. So the only way to do this would be if you had someone who had $1 billion and was a lawyer and was allowed to invest it in their own firm.
But so they'd have to practice. They'd have to have licenses to practice in each of those states.
They'd have to have licenses. That's right. Which is another issue. That you have to have licenses to practice in each state, which other countries do better. In Canada, you can basically practice across provincial lines with minor restrictions. Mm-hmm. The same is true in Australia. You can practice across provincial lines for the most part. In the U.S., you have to be admitted in every state where you practice, and it's the exception rather than the rule that you can serve someone in another state with a problem in their state.
I see. So if I live in Virginia and I have a Virginia issue, I have to have a lawyer that lives in Virginia.
Or at least a lawyer who's
licensed in Virginia.
Right.
Although I think in this area, a lot of people are licensed in all three areas.
True. But if
because
you have a
they recognize the reality.
Right. But if you have a problem in Virginia and say it's related also to a problem you have in Florida, if you have, you own property in both states and you want to set up an estate, for example, set up a will.
You'd have to have a lawyer in both places.
You need a lawyer in both places to deal with a lawyer that has both issues, that's going to handle both issues.
Wow. That does get to be a little bit expensive, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and complicated.
Do you see any way that there's a possibility of this, that we can cross state lines?
I think we're seeing that more and more as we're seeing more online services. There's a lot of pushback now from online legal service providers who want to provide services nationwide, but it's tougher for them to do it if they have to do it by finding a lawyer licensed in each state. So much of our law, while there is a separate set of laws for each state, so much of what you're dealing with as a legal issue is very much the same from state to state. And even when it isn't, you're not paying a lawyer for their ability to know the answer off the top of their head. You're paying a lawyer
that's why
for
you
their
have
ability
research.
To find an answer.
Yeah, that's why you have research.
Right.
That raises some very fascinating and tremendously interesting issues. Tom, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a very enlightening interview, and I hope that a lot of these good things come to pass for consumers, because I do think in running Call for Action, one of the frustrations that we hear from consumers is that they just don't feel like they can get legal services. So anyway, you have been listening to Of Consuming Interest right here on 1500 AM. My guest has been Tom Gordon. He's the Executive Director of Consumers for a Responsive Legal System. And you've been tuned in to 1500 AM. And if you want to contact me, Shirley at callforaction.org. Thank you.
Of Consuming Interest is a public service program presented by WUSA 9 Call for Action, hosted by Shirley Rooker. Call for Action is an international nonprofit network of hotlines which offer free and confidential assistance. If you have a complaint, contact Call for Action at 301-652-HELP. That's 301-652-HELP.